Let's sit. No more. Let's learn. Let's evolve. Let's talk. Today is Let's Talk Social Justice with your host, Kevin Yowie.
Good morning. You're listening to AAA Murray Country. I'm Kevin Yowie, your host for Let's Talk Social Justice. But as a Waka Waka and South Sea Islander man and visitor to this country, I'd like to first begin by acknowledging the traditional owners, custodians and caretakers of these lands, of which I meet on this morning here at the AAA radio station in West End, and pay my respects to the elders past and present. This week, we're kicking off a new series of shows looking at the intersections between colonisation, capitalism and climate change. We're looking at the ways that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples are on the front lines of the struggles against ecologically and environmentally destructive practices. Everything from mining and coal seam gas fracking to plastics pollution or the destruction of remnant bushland and sensitive habitats for the sprawling new developments. For most listeners, you probably already realise that human-induced climate change is an existential threat to everyday life in this place, and that it will disproportionately impact Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and our lands. You might not, however, have also realised that this means that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities are often at the front foot of the struggles for climate justice on this continent, and that the fight for self-determination and land rights for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is essentially to the fight for climate change on these stolen lands. To kick off this series and to start digging into the deep and important links, we're thrilled to be playing recordings from a recent event here in Meanjin, hosted by the Institute for Collaborative Race Research over in Woolloongabba, where I'm a director also. This event was called Sovereignty and Climate Justice, and it featured a panel of phenomenal activists and organisers reflecting on the intersections of Indigenous justice and climate justice in this place and beyond. In the recording that you're about to hear, you'll be listening to our brother, Bo Spearham, who's no stranger from these parts, who is also the former host of Let's Talk, an all-round political icon. We'll also be joined in this pre-recording is Tila Watson, Jacinta Bly, and members of the Beehive Design Collective, a widely motivated, volunteer-run activist arts collective dedicated to cross-polluting the grassroots by creating collaborative and anti-copyright images for use as educational and organising tools. This wide-ranging discussion is one you'll want to listen to over and over again. So get your pens and your cuppa ready and listen to this pre-recording. I'm Kevin Yowie. I'll see you next week here on Let's Talk Social Justice. And my name is Kevin Yowie, and I'm a Waka Waka and South Sea Islander man. I'm born and raised on the stolen lands of the Batchelor people in Hervey Bay. I've been living down here on this country now for almost 18 years, and I am a director here at the Institute for Collaborative Race Research, which is home of the Southside House here. So in keeping in protocol, I'd like to first invite Tila to read her poem of Acknowledgement of Country.
My name is Tila Watson, Birrigubba Wirri and Gungaloo. I have this little poem. I want to acknowledge the Jagera and Turrbal peoples, who come from and gathered here and lived with these lands for thousands and thousands of years. Scientists, conservationists, sustainable farmers, ecologists, they have their own education systems for their own sacred knowledges. A part of a continent governed in a way that didn't require war. Sacred beings in autonomy, strong in their law. No need for a greed-based economy or a needs-based monopoly that continually steals. The sophistication of these peoples from these places is still unmatched to this day, despite having to deal with the trauma of the efforts of the colony to have the truth concealed. They continue to heal, and we acknowledge them in their continuing sovereignty. They have belonged and will belong. Their connections to their countries will outlast us all, just as it has the policies of the past, just as it does the concrete and glass. I also want to acknowledge that land itself is sovereign to us all. Creator spirits still cause, call, rise and fall. We are still in creation. Scientific explanations include the very foundations that we have respected for ages. From my country, Mundagara, the rainbow serpent, for me rests in deep water holes. Yes, that means water is sacred. My sacred tree, the small briglow, grows on the banks of what we now call the Dawson, teaching me my roots run deep. my grannies and grandbabies' countries will always be home. No matter how much they disrupt, turn over, infect and corrupt, me and my country got strong love. They can't muck that up. Connection, inseparable spiritual bonds, even if they try to turn my river into dried up dams and ponds, I know we will come back and flow on. They stole our tongues and kept us from our songs, but the message still lives and has to carry on, as it is country who sings us, ancestors, through time and back and forwards forever long. Big corporations dig up coal and send it off to harm the sacred essence of existence. Me and my country, we still stay persistent, even if there's parts of both of us missing. Indigenous peoples have belonging that cannot be truly dispossessed. We have the power to find sanctity within our own divine breath. No Aboriginal people have ever ceded sovereignty in this continent. We know that even breathing is a reciprocal relationship with the natural world that we live in. We have a sense of knowing that comes from country, different from their mythology, superstition, or religion. Our belonging with this place is not something that can be owned by the colonial governance system. We know that their shadow knowledge causes destruction that cannot be forgiven. We know this farce is upheld by violence and division, and our true ownership cannot be sold, stolen, or given. We know they displace our bodies, sometimes even spirits and minds, through ongoing genocide, race-based hate, ongoing war crimes. And through the living out of their entire ontological design, we know that they do the same to country, with false ownership and ecocide, through their farms, poisons, pollutions, and mines. But we know we are still here and will not be confined. We know the Jagera and the Turrbal tribes. They deserve respect for their sovereignty, their ancestors' lives, as well as for their current part of the sacred continuum of culture through time. So we acknowledge them now while they continue to heal, to remember and to thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Sis, for that very poignant and meaningful acknowledgement of country, especially for reasons why we're gathering here this afternoon, a sovereignty and climate justice panel discussion with our brother Bo Spearham and the Beehive Design Collective as well. As I mentioned, my name is Kevin Yaoye. As a director here at the ICRR, I'd like to welcome you to this space. In a nutshell, I mean, ICRR do a bunch of different things, but I like to describe us as a one-stop shop to fighting racism in the colony. So welcome this afternoon to this space that we think it's special, and I know some of the work that's come out of this place has been special as well, and that's largely because of the extended community in which we work with here as well. So thank you all for coming this afternoon for what I know will be some really staunch sovereign conversations around sovereignty and what climate justice means here and in the now. On behalf of ICRR, welcome to this space, and thank you for coming along.
Hi, everybody. My name is Darius. I'm with the Beehive Design Collective. My partner here, Saku, is also in the collective. We're on tour with our two little hooligans traveling through so-called Australia as part of our tour of this side of the Pacific. We don't get to this side of the Pacific that often. So we started now with Te Aroha. We're moving our way up. We're going to be going to Indonesia, Philippines, Korea, and Japan next. But we feel very blessed to be here. I met Bo about almost 10 years ago now, and so we've been linked for a while, so it's just really nice to kind of catch up in real life with the comrades, right, with the co-conspirators for, you know, liberating all land from colonial governments around the world. So anyways, this piece right here is called The True Cost of Coal. All right, so I'm going to go through this graphic real quick for y'all, so check it out. Our story begins with the creation of coal in the ancient marshlands and the forests of old. The plants that lived there never got to decay. Instead, their carbon got buried away. The original peoples, they lived with the land. They took from it too, but they worked it by hand. This method did limit how much they could take, which worked out much better for everyone's sake. Then the colonists came, bringing their baggage. They brought disease too and did lots of damage. Treaties were signed by the Cherokee chiefs to keep land for their nation to live on in peace. And although the U.S. signed those treaties before, the settlers were greedy. They still wanted more. The treaties they tore, people's rights they ignored. While the Cherokee Phoenix would report and record. They petitioned, protested, and sued in the courts. But the U.S. president removed them by force. They walked through the winter with so little food. Many died on the journey. They cried as they moved. Their forests cut down. Train tracks stretched for miles. Coal, cotton, and lumber to make money piles. Wanting homes and employment, the settlers moved west and got trapped in the company towns with their debts. Workers weren't paid in money, just company scrip that they had to give back for their food and their rent. Enough was enough. The miners fought back. They picked up their guns and they launched an attack. They wore red bandanas. They shut down the mines. They went out on strike and they held picket lines. The government sided with bosses, of course, and sent in the army to use lethal force. The plight of the workers would soon get much better. They sang with their union, solidarity forever. But as soon as things moved in the working man's favor, a monster appeared and replaced most their labor. A continuous miner crushed coal and their lives. So the community as a whole had to get organized. They picketed and lobbied, even broke those machines. But at the movement's peak, got sold out by big greens. Rather than stopping the mechanization, those green groups just pushed for mere regulation. Mountains got destroyed even more than before. And those miners, they couldn't find work anymore. The machines just got meaner and badder and bigger. The people got poorer and sadder and sicker. The coal fueled the wars and consumption and greed. The climate was changing to chaos with speed. But the rich just got richer as coal smoke filled the skies. They made inside deals that would keep profits high. It was clear to the people who watched from below that they'd have to rise up and resist and say no. They passed out petitions, they signed with their paws. They held up the permits by studying laws. They tested the waters, the coal trucks they blocked. They made painted banners and rallied a lot. Some people resisted while others rebuilt. The local economy, the soil and the silt. They cleaned up the toxins with mushrooms and plants. Built kitchens and gardens. Wrote music and danced. The fences came down. First peoples reclaimed. The lands they'd been missing, traditions and ways. All peoples united, the monster was dead. There's wind, sun, and currents that we use instead. Seas to be saved, rainwater to collect, and community was built around love and respect. The people in cities kept busy and buzzing, but now they were working together on something. They built housing, collectives made better decisions, and figured out life without coal or emissions. We all have a role when we build from below. How will you help your community grow?
So I don't know, how we kicking this off?
Well, just to kick off, Yama, my name is Bo Spearum, Gumaroi Kuma Marawari, born in Western Sydney and grew up on the south side of Brisbane. Went to the Murray School, you know, very informative, important time in my life because, you know, one, it was a school that was like 99% black kids, you know, quite a few Aboriginal teachers. And we had a dance troupe, you know, and everybody looked like us, talked like us, you know, so it was an amazing thing, you know, when you look back at that, and then when you have kids and, you know, they don't have the opportunity to sort of experience that as well. I went to Sunnybank State High School, very multicultural school. We had a lot of refugees, come to the school from different parts of the world. And then, you know, we end up like, you know, 1% of the school. So I went, you know, from a primary school where we were the majority and, you know, there was a huge emphasis on us, our identity, you know, our history, our culture, to a place where, you know, we were just sort of put to the side as well. That had a huge impact, like it would, I guess, with anybody. I graduated high school. You know, did a whole bunch of things from security to factory work. It wasn't until like 2012 when the embassy got set up in Musgrave Park. And then when I sort of, you know, fell into like radio, community radio is where I found myself. And, you know, I've sort of been active within those spaces since then as well. And through those two things, I've had the opportunity to, you know, go around the world, go around Australia, you know, you know, do a whole bunch of cool things and meet some really deadly people, from elders to young people to, you know, other mob to non-mob as well. So I've had, you know, pretty cool journey over the last 10 years, 12 years, since sort of stepping foot in the embassy back then as well. But I guess what we'll do is we'll quickly swing through and let everybody else introduce themselves really quickly as well, and then we'll sort of get into the yarn as well.
Yeah, so as I said before, my name's Teela Watson. I'm Birigaba Wiri in Gungaloo. Birigaba country, the Wiri clan that I'm from is west of Mackay in a little town called Nebo at that area. And Gungaloo country is like central Queensland on the Dawson River. People might know of Moura or Bilawila. Yeah, that's my country. I was born and raised here. Same like Bo, went to Murray School. And I think that's one thing, like going to Murray School really, like when you just, it was like living in a deadly little black bubble, you know. You heard about racism and you knew history and you knew what was going on, but you didn't have to live in it. You got to live with your mob. And I think that was really influential on me too, because, we got to grow up in a place where our people and our knowledges and our history were centred, you know. They were at the centre of the world, you know, being a child. So that was really important. So I'm also an artist, and my artist name is Ancestress. And I'm going to pass it on now.
Just really quickly on what you were saying, since in regards to like the Murray School setting, one thing that, you know, I guess we got to experience in that setting is now we know generations of people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because we went to school with somebody, we know their family, you know, like, which is sort of this interconnected thing that we've always had as black fellas as well. So I think, like, just as Sis was mentioned, that I was like, it just clicked, you know. Irregardless of sort of the times we live in and the things that are chucked at us, you know, we still have these like sparks of sort of, you know, connection that we can relate to as well.
Now it's me. Shut up now. I'm a Waka Waka Kalali and Cobble Cobble woman. I was born and raised in the South Burnett, so I spent about 17 years in a little place called Mergan. Does anyone know where Mergan is? Holy shit, two people. There we go. And Millie, you only know where Mergan is because of Sherbet. Let's not lie, that's a truck stop before there. So I grew up in a really sort of life marked by duality. So Mergan State High School, it's a pretty rural school. It's got an ag class. It's great. But it's about sort of 50-50 split between mob and white fellas, and it's this really sort of interesting dichotomy between the colonizers, their children, their descendants, and sort of like a lot of the TOs around. So there are instances, say in my own family, for example, where my mum and my dad met each other because they both lived in the same town, and then about 25 years later I found out mum's family colonized my grandmother's country. So the sort of southeast Queensland, when you get into them rural places past Gympie, it becomes a really interesting place that's sort of founded upon not only colonialism but that hyper-liberalism. If you know Pajolki Peterson, born and raised in the South Burnett, so if you ever go there, just be aware they love him to this day. So I've been blessed to sort of grow up partly between Mergan, Dalby and Cherbourg. Dad was always real big on dragging us kids around on adventures. We even went up to like Harvey Bay quite regularly with all the mobs. So we got these intergenerational connections that have existed since colonialism, but also since before colonialism, that we're sort of having to rediscover in a contemporary sense from looking at it from that old lens that has been so far removed from us because of brutality, that we're starting to circle back to it slowly, and these conversations are happening. And it's important that, like, small rural towns are an interesting thing because the farmers and the blackfellas, they get along. You talk to any fella around Cherbourg, Mergan, you got the Brisbane Broncos? You got the Mergan Mustangs, wrong horse. You got the Mergan Mustangs and the Cherbourg Hornets. A lot of the fellas will switch teams. They'll play for both sides. So I come, yeah, from a place of duality that's informed not only my history, but my future. And that's sort of one of those old Cherbourg sayings is, no matter where you go, remember where you come from.
Raising things,
eh? That's it. I got one.
Oh, you got your own.
Hi, everybody. I go by D, or Darius, part of the Beehive Collective. We've come here from Mi'kma'ki, the land of the Mi'kmaq, on the east coast of so-called Canada, in Turtle Island. I'm not Mi'kmaq myself. I'm not indigenous to Turtle Island, but I've been involved in a lot of solidarity work and anti-colonial action for about 18 years now. And met Bo when Bo came on the Aboriginal passport back in 2014, and we've been friends ever since. I was actually wearing this shirt when I met him, so I was like, yeah, I gotta bring this shirt. I'm gonna wear this shirt when I see Bo again. She'll be like, oh shit. Second time here in so-called Australia, sharing this artwork. I also do hip-hop music, and I might spit a piece or two later as part of this event, yeah, here with the Beehive Collective, and excited to have such an awesome gathering of people here to have this important conversation.
Hey, everybody. I'm Saku. I'm part of the Beehive Collective, obviously. I also have, for almost like 15 years, worked with communities directly impacted by mining. And that's actually kind of what makes me feel very connected to Australia, because me and my friend Nat Lowry from other sides of the world kind of jumpstart this global network against Barrick Gold, the world's largest gold mining company, in 2007. Just an activist, a mom, an arts educator. My background is also a settler. Well, we're both kids of immigrants. You know, that's shaped, you know, in a, you know, it's really ironic in all these different places, or I don't know, cruel or something, that, you know, these places that are so colonized then regulate who can come in and out, and they close the door of the people that are most closely related to the original people. They're all in the neighboring islands, and in our case, Mexico and Central America as well. So happy to be here with this great crowd.
Just sort of kicking off the event, you know, the name of the event tonight is Sovereignty and Climate Justice. What I'd love to do is, in your own words, like, each of you sort of answer what those two things mean to you. Is it linked? Is it separate? You know, like, what does it mean to be mob on this country? And then, I guess, what does it mean to be non-mob, you know, back in Canada, but then also here, talking about those two separate things as well?
Good question. My idea of sovereignty is very broad. It's a broad term, and I think the thing with blackfellas using English, you know, we had hundreds of different languages, and most blackfellas before colonialism would have spoke at least probably 6 to 7 to 10 different languages. So it's interesting, because what we tend to do with Aboriginal English, with the way that blackfellas use English, is like we use certain words in certain ways. And one word can mean many different things. I mean, I think that's also a human thing. Like, we all know what mm-hmm means, or mm-mm, you know. It's about tone, it's about all that sort of stuff, but that's another thing. But I think with sovereignty, it depends what context we're talking about it, because we understand the idea of, and the way that white fellas use the word sovereignty, and that applies to us. And we understand the way that we view sovereignty as a collective, and that applies to us. And we understand the way we use sovereignty personally, in terms of bodily sovereignty and autonomy. And, you know, one of the things that my kids always say is, I'm boss of myself. So it's like, you know, that's what we got to start introducing them to, the concept of strategic cooperation, which Aunty Mary Graham talks about. which Aunty Mary Graham talks about as, you know, blackfellas invented strategic cooperation. But that is what it is when you're sovereign, right? It's strategic cooperation. There's all these different things that in our governance systems we govern ourselves and we govern our sovereignty and the sovereignty of others. So I think, yeah, sovereignty is a very big kettle of fish for me because we use it in all these different ways and it's very important on all of those different levels. The way that our sovereignty, I guess the most like pure perspective of our sovereignty is about where it sits within our ontological system, which is like the what we perceive to be life. And our epistemology is like how you live what you perceive to be life, right? So our sovereignty is both in our ontology as well as in our epistemology. And within our epistemology, our sovereignty is basically epistemology, the way that we live what we perceive to be life. For blackfellas, our law is our epistemology. That's not like that for other peoples. But what that means is that our sovereignty, being governed by our law, is governed in some respects from a blackfellas perspective of climate justice. Because climate justice is about what is a good future. What is a future that is ethical? What is a future that is proper, you know? And not just in terms of what we do to country, but in terms of what we do to each other and how we treat each other. And so it's all interlaced and all interconnected. That's what I'm going to say.
So sovereignty, it wasn't something that was born into my lexicon growing up. I don't think it was born into sort of any blackfellas lexicon sort of 90s, 2000s, for me at least, in a rural setting. But I grew up on the concept of what Dad framed as birthrights. And Dad's birthrights he considered was his country, his culture and his people. So it wasn't just one facet of your culture. It was every facet is your sovereignty. That is your birthright. You are responsible for multiple things. You're not just responsible for yourself, for your family. You're responsible for your extended bloodlines, your alliance connections, your kinship totems, your extended family's kinship totems. It is such a wide-reaching net, and much like Arnie Teal has said, climate justice is a part of that. It's not separate to it. It is a piece of that puzzle, because to me climate justice means my nan's totems get to stay around, whereas so Mapuche people, so me and Bo, well, Bo got to bring some of our brothers to Brisbane, what was it, a couple years ago? And the one thing that we got talking about was Araucaria trees. So if you don't know them, that's your monkey puzzle trees, your Norfolk pines, and around Queensland, your bunya pines. All of them are susceptible to diebacks because of colonialism, because of waterborne and soil-borne viruses brought from external places where these species do not have the genetic resistance to them. They a completely foreign entity. So when we think about climate justice, it's not just a tree is a tree. It's not a river is a river. It is these are people who aren't humans. And I think colonialism has separated not only Indigenous people internationally, but also Western Europeans from that. You've been sort of removed from the environment because of monarchy, because of the money, because of everything. So it's about sort of circling back, much like you talk about the sort of snail spirals. You come in spirals, but it also kind of circles back around to a point. So I think, to sum it up, like my sovereignty is my birthright. It's just my right to my country, my culture and my language. And that is something that has existed well before UNDRIP ever was conceived or even written. So it exists prior to, you know, these institutions and international people suddenly coming on board and realising Indigenous people actually do exist. We've known that for a while, so thank you for recognising it, but it's to the next step of what do we do now? We've had that recognition, now we've got to put in the work to achieve something better than what we've got at the current point in time, because it's a sort of downward spiral, but I'll pass it on.
Thank you. I guess next, it'll be, it's obvious, you know, like why we got you here is because of the work that you do to speaks to the movements that you are involved in. And I guess the sort of the voicelessness of sort of the struggles that you, you know, are a part of, or that you see that, you know, should be, you know, more in the forefront or should be more heard of as well. I'd love this part for you to just sort of speak on, you know, how your work sort of translates to sort of sovereignty, you know, climate justice, you know, and a better future.
It's interesting because, like, that's, you know, that's one of the things. And, like, yeah, it's a lot. But I think for me, it's like I have had this very lucky upbringing in a very cultural family, in a very political family, in a very cultural community. And, you know, Brisbane Black till the day I die. We are a very, very deadly community. And there's a lot that growing up in this community has taught me about what it means to be a black fella. And that translates down as what it means to be human, really. And that, you know, my dad, who has now passed away, he taught me a lot, you know. And I think the thing is, like, when you understand your relationship with the earth and your relationship with your country and your relationship with your people, it's not a separate thing. So I know that, like, when I go through something and, you know, because different times you use art as an outlet, it's like a therapy, you know what I mean? Like, so when I go through something and I make a work about it, yeah, it's like a very personal thing that happened to me and I was physically affected by it, but it's like I know that there's other sisters out there that this happened to, or other siblings, or, you know, brothers, aunties, uncles, nieces, nephews. There is going to be nieces and nephews that this happens to. There's going to be grandchildren, you know, and it's not, it's like that whole idea is kind of a separating, but I think for me, like, I had to really, I went through this really, like a stage of like very intense growth, you know, learning off my dad before he passed away. And I was trying to figure out a lot of stuff. Like, I had a lot of trauma, I had a lot of things I was trying to figure out in my head, you know. And what happened is I spent a lot of time with my dad and I learned about, at that time, no one said climate change. Everyone said global warming. Well, actually, no one said global warming. No one believed in it. My dad was like one of these crazy people who walk around, talk about global warming. I was like, okay, uncle. But, you know, he was very passionate about it. And I was at a stage in my life where I could actually be quiet and listen. And I'm very thankful for that, because what it taught me was, like, every one of these issues that we face as black fellas, it all comes back to the way and how our country is being treated and what our country is experiencing. And, like, bless, I've never been able to go to uni. Like, I tried once, it was bad. I probably never will be able to go to uni. But I'm very good at sitting down and listening to elders, which is also why I make work. It's not necessarily for a movement. It's kind of like, you know, I've been very lucky to have this knowledge handed down to me. And the thing is, like, there are people who will say, oh, you're very privileged because you grew up in with your family, with your culture. And it's like, well, actually, I'm very obligated, you know, because when you learn generational knowledge, when you've been given that knowledge and when you've been trusted with that knowledge, you have a responsibility to take care of it, and an obligation to honour it. And I think, yeah, so it's not necessarily, I don't look at it like that. But anyways, back to what I was saying about not going to uni. I would really like for somebody to do a PhD or some sort of level of study. I don't really know that much about it, but I want someone to cross-assess the health of our countries with the health of our people. And I don't mean over the board. I mean, you know, I'm not putting my hands up to be a study, but I will sacrifice myself for the people. Dang it. But I want to see the health of Gungaloo country and the health of our river and cross-assess that with the health of a Gungaloo person. You know, because the reality is they're killing our land and they're killing our people. And so, yeah, I can't remember what the question was anymore. But that's why I make work. Ah. No, but it's like I don't know. I'm like, you know, you feel things, you know things, you want to say things, I guess. For me, a lot of the work that I've made, I haven't shared. A lot of my, actually, like, before I went through that learning with my dad, before he passed, and this is like, you know, 10 years almost ago. But before I went through that, I had trained through my teenagehood as a performer, and I didn't think I would perform again. I didn't think I would continue trying to be an artist. I didn't see that. You know, I didn't think I could do that. But then through that learning with the material that I was creating, I made this process where I would sit there and I would repeat back to my dad what he told me in a song or in a picture or in a poem. And he would correct me. And that was a process that I then took on, and I've gone through that process with my auntie Lilla Watson and auntie Mary Graham. Whereby it's like, you know, I'm trying to check, is this correct? Is this what I'm learning, you know? So I think once I started making material like that and I realised how much colonialism really affected our mob, but also like how much more there was to our existence, because like that, even going to Murray School, you're not necessarily like, it was drilled into us, but you're still in this society, you know what I mean? So it's like realizing how much life we're missing by not being able to live properly on our countries, realizing the gravity of that. And then creating work that my dad was like, yeah, that's it, boom, you did it. That's what I taught you. Getting the work to that standard where, you know, Auntie Lilla, I can like be like, Auntie, I wrote this thing. And she's like, no, that's good. You know, for years, I would just this word here and that word there and this, and that's a really important process. Yeah, and that's an important process. But getting to that point, I'm like, I can't not share this. I don't want to get on stage. I don't want to perform. But I have to say this. But this isn't not, I'm not up here talking about myself. I'm talking about this knowledge, and this knowledge is important. And that's one of the sayings that Auntie Lilla has. It's like, similar to something that you said earlier, we have to ensure that our future stretches as far in front of us as our past does behind us. And I think that's my idea about making work with the knowledge, you know? Mm. Sorry.
It's a bit similarly to like Auntie Teela in the respect that I produce bodies of work based off conversations and stories that family members and I have. So it's an indirect way of recording family history without writing it all out, dotting your I's, crossing your T's, because unfortunately, I think all blackfellas were a bit sceptical of putting all of our traditional knowledges out there, because of previous instances, it's gone for a while, previous instances of that knowledge being abused, that knowledge being taken by non-Indigenous people and profiting off it. So in a way, I tell family stories that if you weren't somewhat connected to the family, you like these ones over here, you would think those prints are just pretty pictures if you don't know my family or the family history. They're all stories. But it's in a way from like my family, my people have always displayed sort of our history in a particular way where you've got to read between the lines, because the context isn't within the picture more often than not. The context is within a part of the picture, much like this, but the part of the picture is the picture and vice versa. So, like, my art is just the stories of my family that I've been lucky enough to be given, because not everyone has the opportunity nor the obligation, like you're saying, Arnie, to have the family look at you and say, you know what, you're actually worthy of the knowledge, but you know you're going to have to put in a lot of work, and we can see that you're aware of that. So that's sort of where that falls in, is just taking that Mission Cherbourg art history, running with it and taking it back to sort of more traditional aspects, with sort of booting in the doors in museums and saying, look, you've got my artefacts, that's my cultural sovereignty there, you're a non-Indigenous governmental institution, give me the photos so I know what this is for the people. So it's all about, like, I don't know, to me it's the individual telling a part of the collective's story in a way, I think.
Which I think you guys sort of work pretty similarly as well.
I was just going to say that I wanted to focus on how our collective uses animal and plant metaphors, and it reminded me a lot of what you were saying about the trees that are susceptible to these diseases. And I was thinking, oh, that would be, you know, we would really want to highlight that in a beehive graphic, and the similarities between the things that are impacting the natural world and the plants and the animals and the things that are impacting the people. You know, and like, so I just wanted to, I don't know if people can even see it, but in the scene that I said was dedicated to a solidarity economics, there's this image of a Melipona bees, and they're taking care of this vanilla orchid. And then the vanilla orchids are taking care of the Melipona bees. And the seeds and the eggs are joining together to form the phases of the moon to represent reproduction. And that's because the Melipona bee is the only known pollinator of the vanilla orchid. The vanilla bee, the Melipona bee is also very sacred and dear to traditional Mayan people. And there was a time when many Mayan families would have their own Melipona hive, and it's said that the candles made of the wax of the Melipona is the only way you can connect with your ancestors. But the Melipona bee, some of the species are threatened with extinction because of the loss of this traditional knowledge, which is now being revived, thank goodness, and also because of loss of habitat, right? But it's also because the European honeybee produces more honey. So commercially, you know, it makes more sense, even though the Melipona also produces honey, that it's used as medicine, but it produces much less quantity of it. And so also there's this kind of commercial aspect to the loss of the Melipona bee. And we did that to kind of show how, like, the Melipona bee is like this symbol of colonization, you know, remarking about how it's not just land theft, but also the severing of the connection, the intentional severing of the connection to culture, which we saw through residential schools, and we also had those in North America, and the intentional severing of the connection to nature, you know, is shown through that nature metaphor. And so I just wanted to bring that up as just a way that we kind of express things when we're talking about all of the crises that we face as being definitely one of the big root causes. You know, because, you know, everyone's, you know, ancestors were indigenous to somewhere and, you know, had a connection to that land and a whole system of belief that's centered around the natural world. And that's just been so lost. Yeah. So I just wanted to remark on that. And you talking about, how the land of the health of the land is so, like, parallel to the land of the health of the people.
So. Yeah, the health of the water and the health of the people connection. I think that if someone does that PhD or whatever, they would find what you suspect, which is that, yeah, like, people are connected to the river. We are made of water, right? We are mostly water. And so what happens to the waters happens to us, right? That's our blood, right? And so we have to start thinking of it like that. We have to start thinking of, like, our river sheds as an extension of our bodies, because when they're polluting that, they are polluting you, right? And we have to defend waters defend those watersheds in a more meaningful way, right? And that is something that is happening on that graphic there, right? They're mapping out the river in that scene where they're all gathered around in a circle, where you have the fish jumping out of that river that's covered in pollution, dripping in pollution, and that fish is telling the land animals, like, look, there's all this pollution in here, and is explaining that to the land animals that are looking at the map of the river. And in the map of the river cuts through many different territories, many different political boundaries. And so they're trying to map out, where is the pollution coming from? How do we stop it, right? So I just wanted to connect that to that, because it's all connected, right? And then, yeah, with the art, I mean, you know, like, we do make art for movement, right? Like, that is the thing that we do. But we also make art, as a Beehive Collective, we make art to cross-pollinate movements, to deepen people's kind of like understandings of how everything is connected, how it's not just a climate crisis, but how colonialism is central to that, how like workers and the exploitation of workers ties into that, how patriarchy ties into things. We try to tie so many different things together with this, right? We're trying to tie many people's histories together into a common story so that we can kind of turn everyone's attention to the vampire in the room that's, you know, like sucking all of our blood and pushing us all off of a cliff, right? When it comes to like the climate, right? And we have that black hole. I hope you didn't. Right? So we have that black hole at the top, right? And then, so I guess like with our art, we do cross pollination, we do it for movement, but we also do it for like everyday people. Like, we were just at like a festival that is mostly just not activists or people who are like engaged politically at all, but like we were doing this story for people and guiding them through this art and explaining how we landed in this place and how people are organizing to fight to get out of it. And you know, it resonated a lot. We've had people come up to us, we all set up at like public events that are not political, right? And just connect with like random people, and people will sometimes tell us like, oh yeah, I kind of disagree, you know, or I feel like I disagree with what you guys are for, but this art's really interesting, so tell me more, right? And we'll be able to actually like keep talking to them about colonialism and how it ties in to the fact that they live a shit life now, right? It's like, right? And it's just like, you know, if you give us enough time, like, we will turn your mind a little bit, right? Like, we will get in there, right? So so with this art, it's like, it's a way to do mass education, popular education work. That's like a big thing that we do. We take it into schools, and we can have conversations with kids about treaty, right? And about treaties being violated, and about colonialism and how that led to this situation we're in, and what we can do to fight to protect our environments, right? And, you know, like, it might be hard for a teacher to just kind of like come out and like throw all that down in the class, but they can bring an arts group in, and we can then like put up this beautiful art and then guide people through all of that, right? And so that's something that we feel really, you know, really privileged to be able to do. Actually, it's like really important work that fills my heart every time, you know, I'm talking to like a group of kids in a school and guiding them through it, and then they're drawing their own local, because I'm like, draw an indigenous animal to where you're from doing something to protect the environment or to like fight for a better future, and they'll come up with all kinds of stuff, and sometimes it's like way more radical than I would like that I would put out, you know. So I'm not telling you to draw this, right? Like, that's you, you're inspired to do it, right? But yeah, so yeah, we do this to do popular education work.
No more whispering in our mind.
Let's talk Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. on AAA Murray Country, the National Indigenous Radio Service, and iHeartRadio. You can catch up on AAA.org.au. Proudly supported by the Community Broadcast Foundation.